Each of us has a unique career story to tell. For some, these fly high like rocket launches. For others, they're more like the game of chutes and ladders, with advances and setbacks along the way. Either way, we learn countless lessons from these experiences. And that's what we put into the spotlight here at Career Sessions Career Lessons. Join discussions featuring a variety of guests sharing their stories of ups and downs, as well as the secrets of their success and what drives them to continue moving forward. We break down the tools and resources that will help you establish your dream career and realize your professional goals. Here's your host, J.R. Lowry.
Hi, I'm J.R. Lowry, and this is Career Sessions Career Lessons, which is brought to you by Pathwise.io. Pathwise is dedicated to helping you live the career you deserve, writing leadership and career coaching, content courses, and community. Basic membership is free, so visit Pathwise and join today. Today, my guest is Megan Raitz. Megan is a facilitator, teacher, speaker, executive coach, researcher, and author dedicated to exploring and finding ways to improve the way we interact with one another in the workplace. Her recent research, done with John Higgins, focuses on speaking truth to power, examining how perceptions of power enable and silence others. Their work has been featured in Harvard Business Review and in two TED Talks. Their book, Speak Up, Say What Needs to Be Said and Hear What Needs to Be Heard, was shortlisted for the CMI Management Book of the Year in 2020, and a second edition has just been put out this spring. Megan also collaborates with Michael Cheskelson on mindful leadership, and they have co-authored a book called Mind Time on that topic. Megan runs her own business, is an associate fellow at Oxford University's Syed School of Business, and is an adjunct professor of leadership and dialogue at Holt International Business School. Prior to her work at Oxford and Holt, she was a management consultant and a dot-com boom participant. She was educated at Cambridge, gaining an MA in land economy. She also received a master's in change agent skills and strategies at Surrey University and a master's in research at Cranfield School of Management, where she was awarded her PhD. She is also a member of the prestigious Thinkers 50 list. Right. Megan, welcome. Thanks for doing the show with me. I really appreciate it.
Lovely to be here with you.
As I said in the introduction, you have an awful lot going on, which frankly, I probably only partially summarized. Give our audience a sense of the mix of things that keep you busy.
The thing that keeps me the most busy is the fact that I'm a mum of two teenage daughters, actually. Yeah. Genuinely, that's the main thing. And work and everything else happens depending on what's going on with the two teenage daughters. And therefore, it's a little bit unpredictable. But yeah, so I have my work cut out there. I do a lot of research now. So I'm just starting a new research project. So I've got my head in that, which we might get to in a while, no doubt. I write quite a bit. And then I also do quite a bit around conferences and workshops and working with executive teams over time as well. So that a little bit of a lot of different things. And that's exactly what I like.
You, I know, came up as a management consultant. I came up as a management consultant. It kind of makes you a bit of a change junkie.
I think so. And a bit of a portfolio, quite like having your fingers in a number of different pies and different things stimulating and going on. And yes, I enjoy it thoroughly. I really, really enjoy my work.
A lot of people ask me, how do you do all the things that you do? Because I have a range of things going on. And I said, I don't have kids at home anymore. And you'll be amazed how much time that frees up when you all of a sudden realize that you don't have to be driving them someplace or going to some event or dealing with whatever the drama of the day is that comes with having kids in the house.
I cannot even imagine it, but I know that you're right. Yes, it'll be quite a change in about 4 years' time. That'll be the position that I'm in. So be interesting.
So part of your research, I know, focuses on speaking truth to power. How'd you get interested in that topic and how long have you been researching it?
I've been interested in the wider topic of organizational dialogue for more than 20 years. And I suppose, as you just mentioned, I did start life as a management consultant and in strategy. And I've always been interested in conversations. And in particular, I was interested as a strategy consultant, why organizations wouldn't implement my brilliant strategy. And then, of course, that led me to understand and start to be very curious about, well, hang on a second, how do people talk about strategy? What role does power and politics have in organizational change. And that set me up on the path towards understanding conversations and the role that they play. And then also how to change them, because we have lots of habits in terms of the way we talk with one another. So I think that really started. And I also have been a manager myself in the internet industry in the craziness of the 1990s and into the beginning of this century. And that taught me a lot and got me very interested, in particular around cross-cultural communication. And how do we communicate when we're not together? How do we communicate when we see the world in very different ways? And it really just has grown from there.
I thought you were going to say a minute ago that the thing that you wondered when you were a consultant is why companies pay consultants to come in and tell them what they think they already knew anyway.
I do look at that. Yeah, the power of the external voice and the perceptions that we have. And yeah, consultants can play actually quite a useful role in saying the stuff that it's not possible to say if you're from inside the system, because if you said it, you probably wouldn't be inside the system for very long. But it can be also very frustrating when organizations are using consultants to say stuff that their people could be encouraged to say because they know it already. So yeah, that's a very interesting role from consultants.
To your point about how how blunt you can be, I certainly had to learn to tone it down a bit when I moved into the corporate world. Because when you're a consultant, you're expected to deliver the sort of hard-hitting perspectives. And when you're in a longer-term relationship with a company as an employee, you have to play more of the long game and thinking about how's this going to land? How's it going to affect relationships? We'll get into that certainly as we talk about this in more depth in a sec.
Absolutely.
How did you and John Higgins, who you've worked with in this area, how did the two of you connect up?
We actually first met on a leadership program we were both faculty of at Ashridge, which is now part of Holtz International Business School. So he was a faculty member. I just joined the team. And I actually remember meeting him for the first time. And I also remember thinking at that moment, I think I'm going to work a lot with you. And so it was a bit like that sort of click. And I just thought, okay, I think we're going to work well. And that was, I don't know, 18 years ago, something like that.
So you wrote a book together. You've just published a second edition of it around speaking up and listening up. The titles are slightly different in the two editions. So I'll say be more generic and describing it. How did that come about? And give us an overview of what the book is about.
So Speak Up, the first edition is called Speak Up, Say What Needs to Be Said and Hear What Needs to Be Heard. And John and I started working on that probably about 2015, I think, and started a research project called Speaking Truth to Power. John has a background and real interest in understanding power inside systems and status. My interest area was in organizational dialogue and change. And so we began to be interested in particular at the time, if you remember, 2015 was when the Volkswagen emissions scandal happened. There was quite a lot going on in the UK, as there is in any other country, in healthcare, around the consequences of people not being able to speak up when things are going on that shouldn't be going on. So I'd say that really began to interest us and bring us into the research. And then, of course, as well as compliance and ethics, we noticed then organizations became very interested, obviously, in agility and innovation. And again, our lens on it is, okay, how do you enable people, therefore, to challenge the rules of the game, if you like? And how do you get people to speak up with ideas? And then we've also had very big interest in inclusion and diversity. And hang on, whose voices really get heard inside systems? And so Speak Up really started to explore, well, look, we've all got habits. You've got habits. I've got habits of when we speak up and when we stay silent. And we also have habits around who we listen to, what we listen to. All of the listeners to this podcast have habits around which people they kind of think, oh, I think I'll listen to them. And which subjects they kind of go, oh, that sounds interesting. I'm going to listen to that. And these habits define our lives. They define our relationships. They certainly define our careers and our leadership practice. And at a collective level inside our organizations and our teams, they define ethical conduct, innovation, inclusion, talent retention, performance. Speak Up was all about understanding, let's kind of look under the bonnet here. Let's understand why we have the habits that we do. And then, of course, how do we disrupt the ones that aren't serving us, that aren't serving the people around us and that we're in relationship with as well? So that really was where we were exploring.
Power is at the center of this. You mentioned that that's a key area of interest for John. How do you define power, and what do you feel like other definitions get wrong about power?
That's an interesting question. So power, I would say, is kind of the architecture of our habits, our conversational habits. If there is one thing that determines what gets said and who gets heard in organizational systems, it's our understanding of relative status and authority and power. And by the way, ironically, it is also the least likely thing we are to speak about. We don't actually like talking about it, ironically. So how do I define it? Do you know, I don't think we do define it in Speak Up. I'm not that interested in me defining power. I am interested in how others construct their understanding and sense relative power in systems. What I do look at is both John and I are influenced by the work of Joyce Fletcher, amongst others, that looks at how we use the power that others are giving us. So are we using power over others, or are we using power with others? So rather than kind of what is the power, it's how are we using our power in systems? And I also talk a lot about titles and labels, because I think it's a bit more accessible than using this quite conceptual thing around power. I ask people, which titles and labels in your organizational system convey relative levels of higher status and affect people's voices? So in that way, people start talking about obviously gender, race, ethnicity, age, but also hierarchical labels. How long have you been in the organization? Which language do you speak? Where are you located? Are you in the headquarters or in the regions? All of these different sorts of labels affect relative status and authority. And if we can kind of understand that, then we begin to understand the role that power plays in the conversations that we have.
Speaking truth to power, it's a two-way street. You talk about it from the perspective of, I'll say, the speaker and the listener throughout the book. What do you think makes them both challenging? And do you think one is harder than the other?
Psychological safety is probably one of the hottest topics, right, in leadership and management over the last few years, as you're aware. And as are Speak Up initiatives. So, I mean, obviously, every organization I work with is having a Speak Up initiative. That's why they bring me in. But it's almost ubiquitous with organizations trying to help employees to speak up for all the reasons that I've just mentioned. And one of the key things that we noticed early on that people were making a grand mistake in is that they were pointing at the people that weren't speaking up and then trying to make them speak up, or even bringing me in to try and make them to speak up. And I tell it one story, which I tell very frequently, because it happened right at the beginning of our research, and an organization had brought me in and said, look, we have some problems with this particular group. They're not speaking up. Go on, Megan, try and get them to speak up. And the first quote of our research came from when I spoke to them, and they said, last time somebody spoke up around here, they disappeared. And it became so clear, hang on a second, I could work with this group on how they speak up, as we say in the UK, till the cows come home. I could just do loads of work there. It would be an utter waste of time and money and resources unless I actually spend more time with trying to figure out, why do you have to be so brave around here to speak up?
Yeah.
What is it that people in perceived positions of power, especially, are doing that means that it's silencing others, even if they don't intend to do that? So in answer to your question, I'd say it's actually the listening up side that I end up spending far more time with. Get the listening up bit better, and then people might be okay to speak up. Otherwise, you encourage and you enthuse a whole pile of people to speak up with something. They do it. The response is absolutely rubbish. They roll their eyes and go, well, I knew that wasn't going to make any difference. I'm not going to try again. So in that sense, both are important, but listening up is where I really, really focus.
And I certainly feel that running a big part of our company's organization, you want people to be able to speak up. You know, I had one of my direct reports say, well, you do realize how scary you are, right? And I mean, you raised that point a lot in the book, that people in leadership positions underestimate how intimidating the mere fact of them being in that position is. And you may get, as a leader, 20 times a day, somebody may say something to you that took, in their view, real courage for them to say. And you probably don't even realize half the time that what they just said was a big deal for them. For you, it's like one of many things you hear in the course of a day. And it's hard to kind of have a level playing field in that respect, because to really be fully on, fully in listening mode, right, in a way that leaves them feeling like, wow, like that person really heard what I was talking about, I think it's really hard. So I certainly would agree from my own experience with what you just said.
Brilliantly put. A lot of our work looks at how leaders are in what we call an optimism bubble. And when I'm feeling a bit more mischievous, I call it a delusion bubble. Because we can tell in our data, we've also surveyed over 20,000 employees now globally. As you get more senior, you overestimate the degree to which people are speaking up and the ease with which they're speaking up. You'll overestimate how approachable you are, and you'll overestimate your listening skills. And so many of us are in a position where we think things are kind of okay. We're hearing mainly what we need to hear, and we're really quite good at listening already. So why the hell would we want to change our habits?
Yeah.
We don't. And again, looking back at these sort of psychological safety initiatives, one of the trickiest things to do in culture change, as well as just psychological safety, is to convince people that actually they will need to change their own habits here. Because most of us are kind of listening and nodding our head and going, yeah, 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 listening's really, really important. Luckily, I'm quite good at that. I just think my colleagues need to improve. And of course, everybody's thinking that, so nobody does anything. So how we burst this bubble that you're talking about, how we enable leaders to go, oh gosh, I remember when I was them. Of course I'm scary. Of course I'm a bit intimidating. So how do I put this person at their ease so that I can hear what needs to be heard? And how can I respond in a way that means that they'll be encouraged to experiment and speak up again? That's an absolutely crucial role for our leaders and managers.
A lot of the book centers around a framework that you summarize with the acronym TRUTH. Can you break that down for us?
Essentially, we've asked thousands and thousands of people, what stops you from speaking up and what helps you to speak up, and what stops you from listening and what helps you to listen? And from all of those responses, we created a framework which is called the TRUTH framework. It identifies five really key factors that affect whether we speak and whether we listen. And if we want to change our habits in anything, actually, it's a really good idea to, first of all, understand why we do what we do in the first place. And that's what the TRUTH framework's about. It's about us really figuring out, okay, this is what's going on. This is why I make the choices that I do. If we can understand that, then we stand more chance in being able to disrupt those habits. T stands for trust. So the beginning of speaking up I have to trust in the value of my opinion. I have to feel like I've got something important to say and that I kind of know enough about what I'm saying. And trust is the beginning of listening as well, because I don't listen unless I trust in the value of the other person's opinion. So again, anybody listening to this will, well, they won't be with us any longer unless they have something in their mind that says, okay, I trust enough in what is being said here. I trust that it's valuable. R stands for risk. So I may want to speak up, but I'm very likely to then think, yes, but what will happen if I say it? And there's loads of risks around speaking up. To mention some really key ones, they're social. So we like to be in relationship with somebody, but we very often fear being perceived negatively, or we fear upsetting the other person, and that puts us off. And other fears, like fear that it won't make any difference, that's a really big one. If we're listening, we really need to appreciate how risky it feels for the other person to say something to us. And that goes back to what we were just saying just now. So as a leader or a manager, can you appreciate that it feels really risky for this person to tell us this thing? So how can we help them to do that better? U is for understanding, and that's understanding politics, because speaking up is political. It affects people's agendas. It affects our own agendas. And the more we're aware of that, the more we're able to speak and listen effectively. The second T is for titles and labels, and that's back to power. What titles and labels affect who speaks up and who gets heard in this system? What titles and labels do I apply to myself and to others that gives me a sense of my relative power and status in a system? And that's a big one. And then the H at the end is the how to. So I may really want to speak up. I've thought about all the risks and the politics, but do I know how to say something in a way that it will be heard? And listening up, do I know how to invite somebody to say what they want to say and what I need to hear? Have I got the strategy around it? So in an incredibly quick summary of what the truth framework looks like, and we've gone in obviously to each of those elements to try and understand it a bit more.
Maybe just to hit on a few of the points that you mentioned a minute ago, part of the risk thing, it's the risks in speaking up, and as the listener, they're understanding the risks of the person that they're taking by speaking up. Are there risks in listening up?
Huge risks. This actually speaks a bit to my current research, which is, why do we find it so hard to pause and listen or bring our attention properly so that we create a space where people can say what they need to say? And of course, one of the key things in a manager's mind and a leader's mind, who are undoubtedly, given our current environment, incredibly pressured. They're on short-term targets that they've got to achieve. They're busy as hell. They're working into the evening. They're stressed.
Right.
Probably the last thing they actually really want to hear is a problem or something that they think, oh gosh, this is going to create more work. So you open up a space and you really listen. And in some people's minds, it's kind of like, I can't control what I'm going to hear.
Right.
And what if I hear something that I don't know the answer to? Wait a second, I'm a leader, or I'm supposed to know the answer. What if they say something that's really complex and then, yeah, I'm not sure what to do with it? So, right. Of course, when we listen, if we're really listening, it means we're willing to be changed. It means we have to be open to altering what we've planned. If we really step into listening, we're stepping into being prepared to be moved by the person that's speaking to us. And not only at the moment, I think, do many managers feel like they haven't got the bandwidth or the attention to even do that, you're also asking people to kind of open up a space where they might not be able to predict. And of course, the big problem with that thinking is that then we silence. And then we create a huge, great big problem later on down the track, which we really can't control anymore.
Yeah.
So it's a false logic, but it's a completely understandable one, given the fact that our organizations are run as if they're hamster wheels, and nobody dare even step a paw off this hamster wheel because it's going so fast. How do we create a situation where people can listen when that's our environment? It's a tough one.
It is a tough one. And as you say, I mean, with all the pressures that come with being a manager or a leader, like having somebody come to you and convey something, which is a real problem, right? Which is clearly going to divert your mental energy, maybe emotional energy, away from what you were planning to do, conveying, right, in your tone and your body language and your words, that you're open to hearing that, like really open to hearing it. It's hard, particularly when people sort of hit you in the hallway on something when you were just headed to the toilet or headed to the canteen or headed wherever.
Exactly.
You have to really work at sort of slowing yourself down in that moment.
And links into Amy Edmondson's new work on failure, especially. What happens if you create the space to listen and then you hear stuff that you don't really want to hear? Yeah. Something's gone wrong, or there's been a mistake, or there's been a failure. And again, it's false logic. We don't want to hear it, so we shut it down. But of course, that just creates more issues later on as well, and as well as reducing intelligent failures, which is all about innovation.
Well, you make the point that bad news doesn't get better with age. But that was one of the things that sort of caught my attention in the book, and very true. I mean, a small problem in the moment will grow into a bigger problem if you don't deal with it. And you mentioned the Volkswagen scandal. There's certainly been many others. It's sort of lots of little moments where people chose not to speak up or not to hear what was said. They do pile up. And almost always in these cases, you will hear, well, I did tell them, right? But they didn't listen. And you just think it goes to your, as you say, to what Amy's been writing and speaking about recently around failure, that this is how a simple failure turns into a complex failure, right? And an intelligent failure turns into a not intelligent failure. But it's hard. It's hard in practice with everything else in the swirl of the day.
It is. And that's the thing with habits is, as you say, most of the things that we see in the media where things have gone wrong, it's not been a kind of sudden event. These small habits, the small choices that we make every day about whether to say something, whether to listen to something, they often don't feel important today. They feel inconsequential. But if you have the same habits for the next 3 years, year, then suddenly these little habits have big consequences for us personally and for the people that are around us.
Titles was another area I wanted to ask you about. And in particular, I'll say cultural differences in titles. You're a Brit, I'm an American. You go to one of those, fill out your personal information in the US, it's Mr., Ms., Mrs., Miss. If you do that in the UK and it's like Mr., Miss, Mrs., Miss, Dame, Duchess, Duke,
King, you know. Queen. Only in the UK. Yeah.
Yeah. Joking aside, though, do you feel like there are big differences in how people think about titles across cultures?
Yes, but not necessarily just national cultures, is what I'd say. Yeah. Yes, we do see differences, but I see most differences, I think I'd say, probably within organizational systems and even between different teams. So we have different understandings depending on our context on a status and authority. And one aspect of that is the cultural norms that we've grown up in. And so there are obvious differences across the world. And in different social and family systems, speaking up might be encouraged. In some others, it's discouraged. And if you challenge people in authority, it's disrespectful. So we do have different norms across the world in terms of how we perceive status and the impact that it has on our voice and who we listen to. But each team I work with, the labels mean different things. And I can work in one organization where nationality or language might be really important. In another one, not really at all, but how long you've been in the industry or whether you've just come from a Google or whatever it is, that makes a real difference. So it's very contextual, very specific, quite tricky to generalize, over and can be a bit dangerous to generalize over, actually. But of course, we're aware of some general differences that result from different societies that we have around the world.
There's a linkage to diversity and equity and inclusion here too, right? I mean, it goes back to what you said early in the conversation about we all have our, use the example of the one manager who had his little list of the people that fit in, right? I mean, we all have biases toward who we are more and less likely to speak to listen to. And how does that play out in all of this topic of titles?
Absolutely. So one thing I do talk about is, and I try and talk about this in a way that doesn't bring people's defenses up, because I think that can be a real barrier to people shining a mirror on themselves. And one thing I do is I ask people to note down who are the people that they go to, who are the people that they seek out, that they seek out the opinions from. And then just to have a look at that list. And of course, we've all got a list like that because we trust them. Yeah.
Right.
But the problem begins when this list is very restricted, when we begin to be in an echo chamber. And then we have this list of other people that we don't draw on, we don't listen to, we don't seek out. And one of the key reasons that is the case is unconscious bias. Yeah. So trying to understand, are we in a bit of an echo chamber? What are the dangers of that, as well as the impact on the people around us? If we're a manager and we're only listening to these voices, oh my goodness, we've got some blind spots going on. So we better figure out a way that we're going to find out what those blind spots are. So I do quite a bit of work in that territory in terms of trying to get people to really understand. And one of the other things, of course, with titles and labels is when we have the high status labels in a system, we're very unlikely to notice them. We kind of like, we don't notice that when we don't have the high status labels. So when we don't have the, in inverted commas, right labels in a particular system, it's really obvious. It's so obvious that it has an impact on what we say and whether we're heard or not. And I call that advantage blindness. And the problem with it is because we have high status labels, our experience tends to be, I can speak up, I get heard. And then we generalize, we kind of go, well, therefore, in this organization, we can speak up and we get heard. And immediately you forget about the impact that these titles and labels are having and the fact that it is a very different experience when you don't have the same labels. And then we have leaders and managers that may be very well intentioned, but just blind. And if you're blind, you're not going the extra mile in helping people to speak up and be heard.
Sort of draws to mind for me this what's become a cultural flashpoint in the US, this idea of white privilege, right? And I mean, the reality is it is easier to be a white person in most of the Western world than to be a non-white person. It is easier in the work world, especially to be a man relative to being a woman. And we're working at those things, but it's hard when you say, if you have the titles, right? If you are the white male, you want to believe that you sort of created your opportunity on your own. And the reality is that, yeah, you probably have, but at the same time, you had a much different starting point and I'll say glide path or whatever you want to call it to do that relative to a minority woman. And that's the piece I think that is hard for people to accept, right? Because it kind of, it challenges a bit their own story.
So we wrote about this with a colleague, a late colleague, Ben Fuchs, in a Harvard Business Review article, and it's called, Do You Have Advantage Blindness? So we've gone into this topic quite a bit. And as I said, we've surveyed 20,000 employees across the globe in different sectors and up and down the hierarchy. And the gender and ethnicity effect on speaking up and listening up is very clear, and it is statistically significant. So the more white and male you are, the more likely it is that you will perceive other people speak up with more ease than they actually do. Mm. You'll think that you're more approachable, okay? You're more confident that when you speak up, it will have positive consequences. And again, care in generalizing. because I work in such different organizations in such different parts of the world. And as I said, these labels and titles and the ones that people pay attention to and that make a difference differ. We need to know the kind of general categories and situations, and then we need to kind of go, and what is happening for us?
Right.
And what's happening in this team and this organization? And how might we need to reconstruct some of these perceptions around power and status if we're to change anything in a system? And that's, as I said right at the beginning, ironically, that's a difficult conversation to have in the first place.
You've worked, as you mentioned, with a lot of companies all over the world in different sectors. At the corporate level, what are the leaders doing to really crack through all of these challenges, right, across all aspects of your truth framework?
I'm wondering how to answer that question, because my honest answer is, in many situations, my response is not doing nearly enough. And I would put this, I think this is true of many leadership development activities or cultural change projects. There's a kind of interest. It's the hot topic, and we'll run conferences on it and we'll do stuff. But we may not give it the priority over an extended period of time that's required to actually change habits. So the first response I would say is that I think many organizations are working in this territory and doing good stuff, but they'll need to retain it and do it for years to start changing habits. And we're in cultural systems that don't like that message. That's boring. There's another thing that we need to kind of do. We're also in systems that are just so pressed with so many different initiatives. It's very unlikely that we keep our attention to one thing. So I will use that question as an opportunity to say, look, this isn't easy work. It's not work that's done quickly necessarily either. But I am working, definitely, I'm working with a number of organizations right now that have a longer term perspective and an understanding about how you have to keep going. So in particular, I would mention the role that action inquiry processes take inside organizations. And that's a particular interest area of mine. How do you get people to create spaces where they reflect on their experience of speaking up and listening up? They come up with experiments to make in the organization. They go out, they do the experiments, and then they come back and reflect and learn and create another experiment. So these cycles of action and experimentation, which I see, and I'm working with a number of organizations that are focused on this. Now, that shows real promise in terms of changing habits. The other thing I would say is that the leaders that I'm working with that I think are making a difference are also noticing when they're saying one thing, but their actions are saying something else. Mm. And in particular, one thing that brings many organizations down in this territory is that they speak about the importance of listening and collaborating. And yet there are some people that are quite influential in the organization that clearly are the antithesis of that. But they're allowed to stay because they bring the money in or they know somebody. And that is the thing that we need to get real about. And as I said, some of the leaders and managers I'm working with get that, and they're making some quite difficult decisions as a result. So, I mean, I could say so many things to that question, but I'll just draw out those couple of things. The message is, get real about what is needed to really change habits.
Yeah, and I think your point, it's hard, right? I mean, organizations of any form have hierarchy, right? It is the rare organization where everyone is truly, truly, truly equal. I think it's probably a utopian fantasy that there's such an organization. And as soon as you introduce hierarchy in, you've automatically created an unlevel playing field. And whether it's hierarchy or ethnicity or what country you were born in, or whether you're a man or a woman, whether you work in finance or sales. There are myriad ways that the playing field isn't level, and it's really hard to create all of those kind of counteracting balancing factors which make it more level, because it takes real work, it takes real energy, it takes time, and it forces people to confront things that on both sides, the speaking and the listening side, that I think a lot of people really struggle with. I guess it's something we can all keep working toward, I guess is the problem.
But you know what? The vast majority of people that I work with, right up the hierarchy, have actually positive intention. Give them a moment and a space to connect into what actually really matters to them. And they will tell you, I really want to have a positive impact. I really want to develop the people around them. You ask a parent, what's their intention as a mother, as a father? Give them a space and they go right to that place where they go, of course, I just want to have a positive impact. I want to develop. I want to encourage. I want to bring up. I want to help people reach their potential.
Yeah.
The problem is we are in a world that's so fast that we can't attend and stay connected to that intention. And again, I think part of what we need to do is just create those spaces where we can have an opportunity to ask ourselves, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? How do I want to show up? How do I really want to show up here? If we can create some of those spaces, the behaviors follow. We spend an awful lot of time trying to train people in certain behaviors. Great, useful. But actually, a lot of people can do some of this stuff very intuitively. But what they can't do is connect to the thing that where they remember, God, this is exactly what I want to be at work and at home. This is how I want to show up.
Yeah, it's easy to get off course, right? You've had a long day at work. You're tired. You just want to relax. And one of your kids comes to you and needs to talk about a problem that they're having at school, right? And it's hard not to convey some level of, ugh, now. When those situations happen with your kids, with your partner, with your parents, your friends, whoever, right? And your work colleagues, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely. It is one of the most important choices that we make, what to say, how and who to listen to.
Yeah.
Who do we need to create the space for so that they can say what they need to say?
Yeah,
it's just such a hugely important choice. And that's why I just love researching it so much.
You've got a new edition of the book that just came out. What's new? What's different in the new edition relative to the first one?
Well, it has got a new title. As you say, it's Speak Out, Listen Up, How to Have Conversations That Matter. It's completely updated. So I can't remember how many thousand of people we surveyed in the first edition, but we doubled or trebled it by the time we got to this edition. Updated data, there's a preface, and there's also an extra chapter in an area of research that has been another very hot topic over the past few years, which is employee activism. So what sort of topics do we talk about at work? And that has seen a real challenge and a change to wider social and environmental issues. And of course, as we see in the media all the time, we have employees speaking up in very different ways. And how do we respond to that? How do we create circumstances and conditions where we can have conversations that matter? But also, how can we make sure we still survive as a business whilst we do that? And that's a really interesting area. So there's a chapter on that, and also some additional work on technology in particular, which is about to alter dramatically, potentially, how we communicate and what gets said and who gets heard.
I was curious when I read that chapter on AI in the first edition, whether it was sort of a whimsical addition to the book, just sort of musing a bit about how technology could change, or whether it was something that you were thinking about more deeply. You lay out a number of scenarios from sort of like the bot boss to everybody just relying on the facts to basically people sort of spending all of their energy creating their fake profiles on social media. Is that an area that you've continued to think about?
It is. And in fact, we have an article coming out very soon, I hope, in Harvard Business Review again on AI. And my interest is in how will our conversations change, but also how will we have conversations about AI? And they're two kind of slightly different things. The thing that interests me is that the implementation of technology and the sort of positive aspects that might bring have some underlying assumptions, one of which, and obviously there's a lot been written about, it sort of assumes that AI is correct in the data that it then produces and the assumptions that it's making. Another assumption tends to be that it's implemented in an organization that's psychologically safe, that has kind of cracked the whole power thing so that it is used in a way that's beneficial and positive. It also tends to assume that it's implemented in a way that's thoughtful and that we're learning as we're doing it. And that there's some really good reasons why we should question all of those assumptions. And the article that we've got coming out soon, and really the chapter in the book that's on this, examines, well, what role does power play? And as with all of these things, technological advancements may be hugely positive if they are used with that intention. But let me give you an example. If an AI application is able to give feedback to a boss, everybody else who's a human being is actually quite scared to give them. So for example, if an AI app can say, do you realize in that Zoom meeting, you spoke 80% of the time, you never asked a question and you just advocated. And by the way, do you realize that these three people never spoke? And those two people, whenever they tried to, you interrupted them. This is feasible. This sort of feedback and coaching is feasible and could be hugely valuable if it's used in a curious, learning, developmental kind of manner. Right. We can use our power over others with AI, or we can use it to augment our ability to relate to one another as human beings, or we can try and delegate our listening capacities to an AI app. And the latter worries me because these muscles that we need to retain as human beings that give feedback, that sense where the other person is at, that relate with one another, those muscles are getting weaker already.
Yeah.
And we need AI to help bolster them, not to make them weaker still, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, or to further weaponize false information, right?
And that's a big one. Yeah, that of course is a big one, yeah. The conclusion to this article and really what we're saying in the book is, again, I'm sounding a bit like a broken record, where are the spaces where we have the conversations about how we're having conversations with AI? Where's that happening in our organizational systems? Or are we implementing without that level of thoughtfulness or without that experimental reflection cycle that I was talking about earlier on? That's really what I want to focus on. How do we make wise choices rather than make the choices because we have a fear of missing out and because the sector's moving so fast?
One last question, because I know we're up against time. We'll have to get to mindfulness another time. If you think back on your career, what advice would you give your younger self, fresh out of university, about how to think about careers?
Oh, that's so interesting. And I suppose I should actually think about what I'm actually telling my teenage girls, if I was to be really authentic about that. And I do tell them, follow what you are passionate about. Follow, even if you can't see a thing or a target that lies at the end of that. I mean, my experience is if you follow your nose, if you follow what lights you up inside, if you follow something that you just are so interested in, that tracks your path. That's kind of your compass. That's how I've worked. I could never have told you that I would end up where I am and doing what I'm doing at the moment. I didn't even know my job existed, I don't think. But I just, at each path, followed something that just grabbed me. Obviously, it's not as easy as that all the time, but it is an important aspect. And that's what I would tell my younger self to have confidence in. And that's what I am telling my two teenage daughters.
Again, appreciative of your time. When I heard you speak at the conference we were both at in November, the topic of speaking truth to power piqued my interest. So wanted to dive in more deeply. You gave me an excuse to read your book, which is great. And I'm glad we had a chance to talk today. So again, thank you.
Thank you so much. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, I have as well. I want to thank Megan for joining me today to discuss her work on improving workplace dialogue and the importance, irrespective of what industry or country you work in, the importance of speaking up and listening up. As a leader, it's important when you're an individual contributor as well. So with that in mind, again, thank you to Megan. And if you'd like more regular career insights, you can check out Pathwise, become a Pathwise member. Basic membership is free. You can also sign up on the website for the Pathwise newsletter and follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to Career Sessions, Career Lessons. We hope the nuggets of wisdom shared today help guide your path to the successful career of your dreams. This podcast series is part of Pathwise.io, which is here to help you live the career you want. We provide a comprehensive mix of career and professional development events, insights, tools, and exercises backed by a group of leading coaches and other career management experts. If you aspire to something more or just something different in your career, join us at Pathwise.io. You can find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. See you again on the next episode.